Welcome back. Before we start, I just want to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land from which I am recording, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I acknowledge their elders past, present, and emerging. I wish to also acknowledge those tuning in with lived experience of mental ill health. This episode is part one of a two-part episode checking back in with the research program from the University of Sydney's Brain and Mind Centre, Right Care First Time Where You Live. Grace Lee, whom we interviewed last season about this research program, is a PhD candidate with the University of Sydney and the Evaluation Research Manager for the Brain and Mind Centre. Leon Young, our second guest, is the founding CEO of Cognos, a for-profit tech company that creates human solutions for human problems. For Leon, Cognos is the culmination of a creative digital career that spans education, advertising and marketing, behaviour change and games. Thank you, Leon and Grace, for joining me today and for being involved in what I'm sure is going to be a really robust conversation.
Pleasure, thanks.
Thank you, Sam.
Ah, my pleasure. To jump straight in, Grace, are you able to introduce yourself and give us an overview of why you're here today?
For sure. So my name is Grace, and I had the pleasure of talking to you, Sam, last year to kind of give an introduction to the research program. And I think we've now officially hit our 1 year mark. So I'm back again to kind of give an update on how we're going and the exciting partnership that we've had with Cognos since then. So to give the audience a little bit of background, Right Care First Time Where You Live is a 5-year research program that we've been working on. So yeah, we've just officially marked off year one, and year two is where we actually start to implement our research. And I realize that I'm saying a lot of research jargon, so let me just take a step back and explain things in plain English. So we're working with 8 sites across Australia, and we've now confirmed our sites. We have sites in New South Wales, in Queensland, in the Australian Capital Territory, as well as sites in Western Australia. So that's very exciting. Mm. And over the next 4 years, we'll be working with these sites to co-develop or co-design what we call systems models. So systems models are actually decision support tools that many people might be familiar with now with the COVID modeling that you see on the news very frequently. But actually, systems models have been present for a long time and have existed to, you know, forecast the weather and simulate flight paths and etc. And we have the pleasure of working with giants, for instance, Professor Ian Hickey and Associate Professor Joanne Ocapinti, to lead us through systems modeling for youth mental health to genuinely improve the lives of young people. Sorry, that was a long explanation.
It needs a long explanation.
Trying to catch my breath here. But as part of our program, actually, it's great that one arm of the project is to develop these systems models in joint collaboration with each of our sites. But in the past, actually, the process of developing systems models with other stakeholders, which we call participatory modeling, that process isn't well documented. And we actually don't really know what the benefits are of working with diverse stakeholders to develop systems models, because systems models are usually developed with large databases by modelers. But in our scenario, we're actually inviting diverse stakeholders, including young people with lived experience, to develop these systems models. So as part of my PhD project, I'm interested to learn what the experiences are of young people, are of CEOs, of carers, of clinicians, and etc., participating in this type of process, and what sort of return on an investment that is observed by this kind of engagement with stakeholders. So it can be, you know, monetary return on investment, so saving lives through, you know, more strategic decision making, but it can also be more social return on investment, so feeling more connected after COVID. It definitely hasn't been easy, but working together, recognizing the interdependence on one another in the youth mental health system. So yeah, that's a little bit of update. And since then, we've been working with Cognos, which is a fabulous company based in Sydney, where we're also based. And we've been working with Cognos to develop online surveys. But when I say online surveys, boy, does Cognos step it up one notch. We're actually developing gamified online surveys, which means we're actually embedding, you know, activities, games within the actual survey so that it doesn't really feel like a dry multiple choice questionnaire, but it's actually exciting, it's empowering, and it's engaging. So yeah, I'll pass it over to Leon. I realize I've done a lot of talking, but I hope I did it a little bit of justice, what it is that your company does.
Well, there's so much information, but necessarily so, because it is, like you said, it's a 5-year long project, and anyone who is only just tuning in and didn't listen to our previous episode with Grace, head back. But essentially, it's a huge win for the University of Sydney's Brain and Mind Centre to actually be embarking on this project and this research program. And we will actually be in the coming weeks talking with some of the ACT Health members of the community as to what their hopes and aspirations are for this model. Leon, to throw back to you as Grace was going to do, can you tell us a little bit about Cognos and the kind of works? We've heard gamification and not really sure totally what that is, but if you could give us a bit of a rundown.
Yeah, I'll try and keep it fairly brief, just to give you as brief as I can anyway. But to give you some context, I mean, I come from a technical background. In the 90s, I led a company called No Code, which was one of the first companies doing no code building of web and e-commerce and things of that nature.
I've always had. What's no code? Was that just the name, or is that like a technical term?
That's a thing now. That's the irony. We used to own it as a trademark, and we used to own all the domains. And now no code is the hot thing in the tech sector, which is the idea of tools that allow people who are not developers, who don't have formal development background, to create their own software.
Oh, amazing.
So that was kind of an interest of mine going a long way back, and we sold that business in the sort of dot-com crash, sadly, and didn't get to pursue it as far as I wanted. But after that, I founded a specialist agency called 2&2, and what 2&2 did was build initially education and behavior change digital solutions informed from a psychological perspective. And we did that for about 10 years. And over that 10 years, we moved from what I would call a fairly simplistic psychological model to a more neuroscience and neuropsych informed way of building products. And we used to work for people, usually government or large NFPs that had big grants, and build these very expensive products that could be formal education products. We worked with people like Headspace around changing behaviors in schools.
Oh, awesome.
And things like that. But these products would be expensive to build, they'd take a long time, and a lot of the people who had come to us wanting to do these, you know, couldn't afford that and couldn't go through that process. You know, the process would sometimes take a couple of years. And then we'd see these products go out and typically impact, you know, thousands of lives, but the funding envelope runs out. There's no way to maintain it. You see your beautiful product get switched off, and that's kind of the end of it. And we're also very frustrated by the fact that because we were doing lots of these projects, we would see things in one project and we think, well, wouldn't it be great if that was in that other product over here? So 5 years ago, we started with a very ambitious idea. We're going to build a no-code platform for creating apps for this thing that we do, which had no name at the time, but it was something to do with behavior change and health and education. We've since put a name around it. We call it human transformation technology. And the nice thing is, since we've been seeding that phrase out in the market, we're seeing lots of people pick up on that. And the very simple way that I explain it is, if you think about apps, common consumer apps that you might use, if you think of like the number one app for physical fitness in Australia is Sweat, mental health, something like Headspace as a mindfulness app, Duolingo for language learning. There's all of these different apps that are very successful against thousands and thousands of competitors that aren't, because they apply the neuropsych into the user experience design. So they know how to get you to do something that you're kind of motivated to do, but you're probably not sufficiently motivated to do and take you on that journey. And so what we did was we productized the full technology stack, and we productized the design and build process. So we like to think of it on the top end, it's like a Canva. You don't have to know user experience design. We're going to give you the best in class for this type of thing. Then all the personalization AI and the ability to do complex models and take people through different things. And when we started on that, we were really thinking, well, this will be used in a lot of different areas. areas, but it's probably going to be in education primarily. But what's happened is it's primarily used in human research, mostly mental health. So that's become our market of focus now. And, you know, we were introduced to Grace a while ago through other people at the Brain and Mind Center who have done things with us. And mainly what we do now is support researchers in creating these digital products, often mental health interventions. This one's very unique in that it's more a sort of gamified data collection tool, but still using those same techniques. So it was something we were, you know, really excited to get involved in. And as I think I told Grace when I first sort of heard the brief, the problem that she's trying to solve is a problem that we hear about anecdotally everywhere we go in terms of pathways through the mental health system and things like that. So when we got the call to actually work on this, it was really perfect for us, very exciting.
Amazing.
To kind of reflect on that, I remember one of the first meetings with Leon, he did say, Grace, we hear this multiple times, and showed us examples. And I was like, I don't know, Leon. I don't know if we're talking about the same thing. But he was absolutely right. And the fact that we had other templates that he and his team has worked on for multiple years, and to apply that kind of same existing templates and design and all of that into our survey has just been really fundamental. And it's actually, the Canva example is so perfect, because just as how, you know, I have no creative bone in my body, but I'm able to produce something that looks decent on Canva. And just as Leon said, I was able to create surveys using gamification, using previous templates on my own with guidance from the Cognis team. But it was a very empowering process, the whole engagement with the Cognis team. So yeah, really just wanted to emphasize that.
Yeah, it is such a cool idea. And it, I mean, having previously had a career in design, it is really interesting to have seen when we were studying at college, there was a really funny moment that myself and one of my best friends laugh about every now and then when we remember, where we were learning website coding and we both sort of were complaining because it took us I think it took us 2 days to actually center a logo in the web page and have it, you know, move from mobile to no matter what size your web page was. And our lecturer just did it in 2 seconds, knew the code. We were searching, Googling everything. And we said to him, you know, it's so stupid that there isn't a platform that just does that, you know, you can just do this quite easily. And then now they've started to come out, and he was like, no, that's never going to happen. And so things like Canva is really interesting and really cool. I mean, as graphic designers, we tend to hate it, but we also equally love it because it has built-in features that are so easy to use. And when you're working with clients, it's easy to sort of put in certain things and then they can choose from those certain things. And it's very easy from a template perspective. Leon, when it comes to the differences between, I guess, a long-term project that is say an application, or like you were saying, those sort of sleep meditation sort of apps or user-designed products, what is the difference between something that's arguably short-term in its data collecting abilities, like this survey for Right Care First Time Where You Live, and something like that?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and quite complex. So what we think about is what is going to make someone come back to the app at the time you want them to come back to do the thing that you want them to do and that they want to do as well. And, you know, something like this app, where it's about re-engaging people a couple of times in a journey, and that's all it is, it's you've really got to think about what will just motivate them to get over the line at that point, which is quite different to someone wanting to practice mindfulness or get fit or participating in we have a lot of people building sort of addiction treatment programs and things like that, which is a long-term daily thing. And so what you're trying, the key to that really is around personalization. And so we've invested a lot in these sort of simple rules-based AI engines that make it easy to start to recognize what's going on with different parts of your audience and engage them in the optimum way. So for instance, I'll take a very simple example. If it was a fitness app that you were building, no point in sending me a fitness message at 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm not a morning person. You're not going to get me to do it. It's going to seem horrible to me. So you need to know the right time to send that to me. But a lot of other people will love it at 6 o'clock in the morning. Mm. So it's about being able to recognize those different psychographic characteristics and then play to those. And the beautiful thing for people building apps on our platform is that they're not trying to manipulate people into doing things that they don't want to, you know, arguably like a social media site or something where they're just trying to get you on there. They're trying to get you to do something that you want to do, but you've just got a bit of friction to it and removing that friction. So that's really all about understanding what is working for you, giving you the right thing at the right time, and that kind of constant refinement in that journey. So part of what we're trying to solve with our platform is that in the old development model, you might have a design for something. So you might have a sort of CBT program or something like that. You're going to take people through a fixed amount of time to get them to a certain destination. But then you still often want to engage the client beyond that, right, to maintain the behavior, to keep improving things. The old method of let's design something, build it and put it out there kind of works okay. I think it's flawed in any event, but it works okay if you've got a very fixed process. If you're trying to do something that's ongoing, then the app owner needs to be able to look at the data they're collecting, add to it, change to it. And so a key part of our model was let's make it as easy to get the first version of the app out as possible and then allow people to iterate and build on that and make it sustainable, you know, and cost effective to do that over the long term. And that's really the thing that you've got to set yourself up for if you're trying to bring people on that long-term journey.
Mm. And Grace, when it comes to, I guess both you and Leon have sort of answered it in some areas around sort of keeping people engaged and making sure it's intuitively engaged with the individual and what they not necessarily have to do, but what they want to do and what they want to get out of it. Why was this so important to this research program, and why did you want to engage in a partnership with Cognos to do this?
Yeah, that's a really great question as well, Sam. So our research program broadly, community development and empowerment remain fundamental. So we're not interested in going to the research sites and just tick off the box to keep our funder happy. We're actually being guided by the site. So what's important by the site to be modeled is what we're going to listen to and support so that we're able to make real impacts for each of the sites. And in that way, when it comes to evaluation, they're often really poorly funded and engagement is low because people are busy. They don't want to complete a survey and it's dry and it's really around. Yeah, we've all been there. And it's really around getting the researchers' objectives met and not really listening to the people who are actually involved. And we wanted to flip that perspective around. So the surveys are actually going to guide improvements. So we're not going to just say, oops, we're sorry. We realized that we could have done X, Y, and Z better. But we're actually going to embed the surveys multiple times throughout so that we're recognizing, okay, we could have done that better in the first workshops. By the second and third workshop, let's actually improve that and listen to what people are saying. And also in the surveys, rather than having, you know, standard multiple choice questions that are really dry, we're actually taking them through a journey like Leon said. An example of that is, for instance, rather than asking people, you know, what are the challenges of your youth mental health system and the care that you access in your community, we're actually embedding a game. So taking people through a story of a fictional character who is struggling with mental health and presenting them with a game of a map. So based on this map, where should the character go next? What care is available? And based on the care, what challenges might they face? Are there long waiting lines? Are there not enough people to listen to? Is there no one in the community that actually understands their needs? Is there no public transport? Are waiting times and opening hours, are those the main barriers? So rather than, having, you know, dry survey questions, we're actually taking people through that kind of activity where they actually want to take ownership over the question and actually want to complete them, hopefully. And that process was actually guided by engaging with diverse people. So it's not us researchers developing these fictional stories and activities, but we've actually conducted around 50 interviews with diverse people. And they included young people with lived experience, and they also included just general people of the public. So construction workers, teachers, nurses, that's the type of people that we engaged with. And from their feedback is the survey that we developed. So we're really hoping that the survey will be reachable, understandable, engaging, and something that will actually help improve processes throughout. And I think it's really great that Cognis is really responsive and also aligned with us in being iterative and reflective, because we want to not have the survey be the same across the 4 years. We want to listen and improve and constantly refine. So we're very excited that we officially have committed to Cognis for the next 5 years and have this official partnership, because it's been really amazing as researchers to find technical software engineers and designers and coders so aligned with our vision. So yeah, that's been really fantastic.
It's quite funny because reflective and healthcare isn't really used in the same sentence without aren't in between, or isn't. And so in order to sort of produce that or to be change makers within that, it's really exciting to actually hear that through Cognis and this partnership that we're able to truly reflect and hold that mirror up to what those community members and those community stakeholders, not just those decision makers, are needing for their sort of catchment, I guess. Anyone who's accessed quality mental health knows the journey that it is to actually access that, whether it's affordability, whether it's a cultural appropriateness, whether it's at like physical access or transport or wait times is even worse. So it's fantastic to know that it's not just like the same program rolled out for 5 years at how many ever workshops there are over those 5 years and eight sites, but that it is bettering itself each and every time.
And bettering based on what people are saying, not based on what researchers feel and think. It's actually really what the community feel and think.
Yeah, 100%. So, Leon, what are the actual steps involved within the gamification process, particularly when it pertains to something like this survey?
Mm. So I guess I think about it less as gamification and just more about audience and purpose and what you've got to do to achieve that. So you can think of game tools in two classes. So something that's, you know, very nice that Grace is doing here is making the experience of the interaction more game-like itself. So that's really, to me, if you want to get technical about the terminology, that's more using game design in designing an interaction, whereas gamification I would think of as using game reward systems to drive a behavioral outcome. And so we have expertise in both. We came into this from a background of building lots of educational games and things of that nature. But we brought that with us. But it was more about thinking, well, even if the experience doesn't feel like a game, what can we do in that experience that will get the person to do something that they want to do? And when you think about it, all of these digital platforms that you're interacting with are gamified. Whether you're conscious of the fact that they're linking you into a game or not, that's what they're doing, and they're relying on that sort of anticipatory dopamine effect to get you to do the thing that they want, right? Sit there scrolling and scrolling and scrolling, waiting for the next payoff.
Is that as simple as like a progress bar at the top?
Look, it can be anything like that. Anything that gets you to, that gives you that little bit of reward. I mean, the main thing that social networks rely on is the barrage of content, and you will keep searching for that one thing that gives you the hit, and you never quite get it, and so you just keep, before you know, 3 hours are gone, and you know, you've just watched a million TikTok videos, and why did I do that?
But I'm still waiting for my 5-star Uber rating. I think that's a really good example of
that's a more conscious one too. I mean, everything, e-commerce sites, everything is kind of using this, and so we're trying to think about, well, how do you use those sort of tactics or tools in a way that first the end user is consenting to, you know, we try and make it such that the people building on our apps, it's very clear what they're doing, and you understand why you're in this, but you're still getting that reward, and you're getting that reward for something that actually has a payoff, that is actually a positive outcome, rather than just having spent more, you know, time looking at a screen. But it's very tricky because you have to think about things like, you don't want people staying in your product for too long. The product exists for whatever purpose it exists, and so you want to give people enough payoff to do that activity without the product itself turning into another time-wasting thing. And then I mentioned before that we have a lot of customers working in addiction management and particularly, or treatment, and particularly around gambling addiction. And of course, addicted gambler is addicted to these mechanics. So
how do you negate that?
You know, there has to be a high degree of sensitivity as how you're using these things. You don't want to, you know, you don't want to just replace one thing with another thing. You don't want these to be the morphine in place of the heroin. And so when you look at some of the gambling intervention products that have been built, they're much more about reflection, often about peer support and involving people in communities and things like that, rather than, if you look at some of the educational products that people build on this, it'll be more about giving you the surprise reward, giving you the badge, giving you the items of inventory and all of those sort of game things. But yeah, you're not going to use that with an addict, hopefully.
Yeah. How do you balance, I guess, sort of elaborating on that, how do you actually balance the mental health aspect and the hindrance it could potentially have on mental health and the reap and reward, not necessarily, but that side of things where it's like, okay, good job, you've done this far or you've gone this far or that sort of thing.
It's difficult, and it's lucky that, you know, 70% of our customers are researchers. And what we're really doing is providing them with a tool set, and then they're applying that tool set. So to a certain extent, we're kind of handing that responsibility over to the customer in terms of how they do that. But having said that, at the same time, we consider ourselves a for-profit social enterprise. Inquiries that we get about building products where we just say, no, you're not going to build that product on our platform, sorry, you know, because they're crossing that line. So for us, there's bigger, you know, there's a whole other discussion we could have one day about the ethics around these things and how and what the challenge is going to be in terms of how companies like us package up something that allows you to use the technology in all the fabulous ways it can be used without veering off into this other murky place.
Yeah, if I can jump in actually. So yeah. I think how we've kind of gone about that is we've maintained, you know, positive mental health and well-being throughout our survey, obviously because that's kind of the space that we're working in. But like Leon mentioned, the element of reward, so making people feel like, okay, they're getting something and they're getting that sense of satisfaction for completing an activity, for instance. So for instance, we're implementing badges within our surveys for completing certain activities so that you kind of level up. And then the ultimate prize, everyone receives a voucher that they can access at the end of the completion. But we're trying to make sure that we're maintaining positivity. So we include some sort of, you know, fun fact about mental health research or well-being throughout the survey so that there is elements of positivity rather than, you know, addiction and wanting to have that craving. That's definitely not what we're trying to aim for, but it's really the engagement and empowerment. So, and empowerment with information, empowerment with control over sharing their experiences. Working with the Cognos team, it has been very, I've been able to consider things and think in ways that I would have never thought of. So big shout out to the team, Toby, Jenna, and Randy, for helping me, you know, think in different ways that I would have never thought. But actually that suggestion of including fun mental health facts was made by a Cognos team. So as much as Leon said that, you know, the responsibility is sort of with the researcher, I have found my experience to be completely a partnership where the Cognos team has made sure at every step of the way that we are getting the best product for both the university team and the Cognos team. So that has been, yeah, such an amazing experience on my end.
That's so wonderful to hear, because quite often, you know, you do Well, not quite often. Sometimes you can sort of submit an idea and it gets changed and changed and changed through the iterations, and it ends up being so far removed from what the original intention was. One of the core intentions of this program is the discernment between, or the evaluation between with and without, with versus without participatory models. Are you able to engage that a bit more, Grace, and sort of walk us through what that might look like?
Sorry, I should have clarified. So we don't really have a clear-cut comparison of the without or with. We're trying to compare.
That's probably positive for the communities.
Yeah, if anything, we're just trying to not even compare, but constantly improve the with and the with participatory modeling. But when I say that in the past, it's been underreported, I don't mean the comparison, but I actually mean participatory modeling is such a time-consuming, and it takes a lot of resources if you really think about it in the big picture. It takes up, you know, three full days engaging with stakeholders in workshops. It takes researchers going and, you know, actually traveling and working with the community to develop those types of relationships. So it's definitely not something that's it takes a lot of time and resources. But we want to understand what is the value add and why it is important to put in that extra time and resources to actually make sure that it's community driven and participant driven. So yeah, sorry, Sam, if there was confusion, but yeah, we're just trying to understand, because I think there is a study that actually, just got published in late 2021, where over 60% of studies in participatory modeling did not include any sort of evaluation. And participatory modeling is a huge field, and it's just, starting to develop in the, context of youth mental health. But, when we saw that, it was huge for us and, such a underreported area. And it's exciting to be able to use novel research methods such as game elements and gamification in our online surveys to report that. And hopefully people not only in the mental health space, but in other disciplines can learn from our experiences and can apply what we're doing here in Sydney, Australia.
Mm. Absolutely. And how, I guess going forward, what do you both see the product of this partnership changing or influencing within mental health care?
I'm happy to go first. That is a very loaded question. So
yes. Only loaded questions.
Not sure what I'm getting myself into by answering first, but I think the crux of our research program, so not only just the evaluation, which we've focused on today, but the crux of the program is actually systems models have the ability to change the lives of multiple. So at a population level, change, prevent suicide in thousands, millions of people. But what's unique also is that systems modeling can also save the life of that one person and look at that one individual. So even though evaluation isn't going to directly save those lives, by being part of this program and having the crux of community engagement, development, empowerment, being the center of everything and reflection and refinement and improvement. I know I sound like a broken record, but,
I'm just trying to get
the messaging that we're going to have. So even though our surveys might look different, even though our approach might look different based on the feedback over the next 5 years, our overall aim will not change, which is to make sure that we're partnering with these sites and listening. And I don't know if that answers the question. It was a loaded question.
No, it definitely does. I think because, you know, like you said, you can't change it for the individual specifically or, you know, where they might be in their journey, but by influencing or hopefully changing the overall, you know, field or sector that that community work in and circulate in, it can therefore then sort of have that influence on an individual's journey.
Yeah, I think it really just comes down to interdependence. So recognizing that evaluation is just one arm of the program, but it's an important arm, and systems modeling is an important arm, and the participation of diverse stakeholders in it is an important arm, but it's the interdependencies that we have on each other that will actually make this work, and that will hopefully work towards improving the genuine lives of young people and their families and carers. So, yes. Mm.
It is interesting to before I first got into research, I sort of thought it was just almost like a one lane sort of a situation, but it is very much a body of moving parts that are all just all with each other and continually learning, adapting, sort of dealing with what each other might be producing and things like that. To actually sort of delve a bit more into that and see that that is super core to this project about the learning and the editing and the producing again, and then the learning and the editing and that's constant sort of cycle. It's really, really exciting, and particularly exciting for someone who has been through and I guess continues to go through the mental health system and all of its challenges.
Mm. And Sam, you said it better than I did. I feel like you take your job. But that's exactly right. And Sam, you know this because you're actually an investigator on our project as well. But it's those relationships that we've built and recognized that will, it's just what makes up this program and makes it so special and unique and new, like you said. So yeah, we're really lucky to have you and have your voice shine through and reach young people through this platform as well. So yeah, it just shows how interdependent and reliant we are on each other.
Well, I think like Liam was talking about earlier in the interview, to a degree, times have changed, and therefore the modes of information has changed, and the modes of evaluation therefore have changed and continue to need to be tweaked. And, you know, a platform like this is a new way and thankfully a successful way of disseminating evidence-based research and newfound ideas and exploring newfound ideas or newfound modes like Cognos and I guess the generalized gamification that you guys are able to do to sort of brazenly use that term. What do you see coming out of this partnership and this output, Liam?
Look, the intro, I guess I always have my digital blinkers on a little bit. So what excites me particularly about, you know, the way Grace was explaining it before is we see the output of all of these different sort of research projects and modalities that are happening on Cognos as leading towards an opportunity to do something much bigger, which is about how we start to apply the learnings from these pieces of research to doing interventions for people that are much more personalized, that use new technologies like machine learning in really positive ways. So again, you know, talking about that positive versus negative, you know, the number one interaction we all have with machine learning at the moment is having advertising targeted at us. Wouldn't it be great if that technology was used to look at your own data with your consent to help you identify issues before they occur, or where risk might fall and things like that. There's, again, that's another thing we could have a whole big ethical discussion about how to do that. And I think there's people, you know, overseas, some quite high profile companies doing projects that I can't see ever going anywhere because, you know, they're sitting inside companies that do advertising and things like that. And how can that work? How can those two things live in the same place? But, you know, it is about that one person and being able to help them at the time that they need helping, right? So at the moment, we have people building interventions where, you know, the more sophisticated ones are trying to personalize those journeys for people. But in the future, I think that idea of being able to bring in more knowledge about that individual and use that to really help them at the time that they need help, there's amazing potential for that. And, you know, that's where a lot of our thought goes, is what's the pathway to that without it being Minority Report? You know, where does that all sit? But, it, you know, certainly the opportunity to do that, whether it's in mental health or in physical health for that matter, to know that someone's of a risk of a depression event or a heart attack, you're looking at similar data often. That's what fascinates me and excites me, and I think, you know, what we'll be doing in 10 years is going to be mind-blowing compared to where we are at the moment. So that's kind of the fun and exciting part of the journey.
Watch this space.
Yes, yeah. 100% watch this space. I mean, we'll be following this space as well, so listen to this space maybe even.
Yeah. It's the scale. The other thing I just should say too is around the role of digital. So Sam, you touched on so many of those challenges that people have on their mental health journey, and a lot of that is about cost and accessibility and location and being in the right place. And I'm the last person to suggest that digital tools can replace what a psychologist can do in a face-to-face session or those things, but to have something is better than nothing, and to have things that scale and are available when you need them and are low cost or cost free, that's, you know, the other side of it that I think is super exciting.
And the empowerment of choice is a huge one. I think when digital mental health and things like telehealth sort of first started to be rolled out, and of course it sort of to a large extent became the only mode of healthcare provision during the pandemic and the really hard troughs of the pandemic. But when it first came out, I think a lot of people, myself included, was really hesitant about the hostility that comes with, or the lack of humanity that comes with interacting purely like this. But at the same time, for some people, it is what they want or what they need if you experience agoraphobia, for example. I was reading a recent article about the future in VR therapy and how a lot of people who are going through something that they feel, I guess, a sort of personal stigma to surmise or sort of that sort of vulnerability or fear or shame. They feel more comfortable and confident expressing and seeking help when they aren't in the same room as someone else. And again, it's not to replace it, but it's to provide another option or another way of service provision.
Exactly. I mean, Grace was talking about using what we call the choose your own adventure game, sort of module in Cognos, and how she's using it in this app. You know, on Wednesday we have a project kicking off that had been waiting to get grant funding with the Luke Prittis Foundation. So Luke Prittis Foundation works with teenagers and young adults on the autism spectrum. And what they're doing is, so in dealing with autism spectrum disorder, a lot of it is about rehearsal, understanding how I'm going to have this interaction when I go outside of the house and things like this. And you're dealing with an audience that one tends to, in a general sense, love digital and love games, and tends to shy, you know, by definition, shies away from anything involving confronting face-to-face interaction. And so what they're doing is taking some of their existing stories that they use for modeling these types of things, building those into a game, but then they're using, we have an element in our product called Studio, which is like, you can think of like the Squarespace, like the really simple app builder. And so this will go out to these young adults and they will tell their own stories and build their own games, their own interactive adventures. So I went out today and I went to the bank for the first time, and these were the challenges I faced and what I found confronting. And they can turn that into an interactive game and then share that with their peers and then have conversations about that experience and copy that thing and iterate it and say, this is what my version was like. So that sort of thing in the lived experience space, I think, is, you know, really exciting, and especially with an audience that is not going to sit in a group therapy session and talk about those things, right? So I'm very excited to see how that goes.
Mm. I think as you were saying, talking about some of those areas that people on the autism spectrum find difficult and how you're able to then map that data and model that data and then, of course, you know, the following on from that, it reminded me of a great TV series that I just finished watching called As We See It. And it follows four sort of around my age, around that mid-20s age group, autism spectrum disordered individuals who are navigating work, keeping work, general life, health, relationships and all of those sorts of things. And it was really interesting to sort of finally see and it's sort of been applauded online for that sort of apt representation of those sorts of things. And yeah, just a complete side note there that's somewhat irrelevant to what we're discussing today. But Grace, I know you know how, and Leon probably as well, how integral it is and how many times people have gone blue in the face from the lived experience community saying, we have to tell our story more than once and we should only need to tell our story once. And when looking at this survey and the ability to, you know, interact with a map and put in where you might go and where you haven't gone and, you know, those sorts of steps and processes to actually accessing healthcare, let alone quality mental health care, it is really wonderful because, like you were saying, Leon, it doesn't just take that information, you know, stores it away or whatever, but it actually takes that information and improves the system or the product of that. And people are able to actually take a step back and be like, okay, yeah, no, that is right. That is right. And sort of see the whole picture of their journeys or their steps to actually accessing mental health care within their own region, and whether that's just a straight go to ED, whether that's calling the police and then going to the ED, whether that's going to your GP or your local headspace, it doesn't matter. And obviously it interchanges per person, but it's really wonderful to know that we are, as a sector, listening to the voices of lived experience who are like, hang on, for years, we've been wanting to just tell our story once, and to be embodying that notion is really, really wonderful to hear.
Mm. And you know this, Sam, like I am such an advocate for lived experience, and it's about time that we finally listen, and it's about time that we give lived experience the appropriate platform, not only through this research that we're doing, but through other initiatives like Leon just described. And I think you just mentioned previously as well, Sam, the ACT, you're doing an interview with them in the next couple of weeks. Very exciting. So the ACT, the Office for Mental Health and Wellbeing, is actually our first site to kick off implementation. So we're actually scheduled to go to ACT, COVID pending, knock on wood, on the 31st of March for our first workshop. And you know this, Sam, probably, but the Office for Mental Health and Wellbeing there do such amazing work in the lived experience space and have done integral work working with young people with lived experience, carers, clinicians, etc. So yeah, it's really exciting to see how everyone is connected some way.
It reminds me when you were just speaking then of the Sherry Chisholm quote, if they don't give you a seat at the table, bring a folding chair. And which is humorous and satirical in its own sense, but there was someone who, oh my gosh, I wish I could think of who it was, but someone said recently in sort of like a TED Talk sort of situation that they wanted to alter that and say, let's build a new table. Let's not wait to be invited to the old table. Let's actually build a new table. And this is very much the essence of what this project and program is doing, is actually not thinking about the rubric that research has previously been under or the policy changes or the decision-making sort of knowledge base, but actually and sort of trying to pull up a lived experience chair or a community stakeholder chair and be like, yeah, we're still here, but you're at a different height and on a different sort of comfort level, but actually recreating that table not recreating, forming a new table that is going to supersede this archaic, monolithic sort of notion of a service provision and the decision making that goes with that.
Hear, hear. I think that's yeah, you've captured everything very well, Sam.
So I guess going forward, and you sort of spoke a little bit to this, and I alluded to it, that we will be interviewing the ACT Health and their wonderful sort of lived experience and community engagement that they do there. And they're obviously, like you said, Grace, the first site. What are the next steps for both you and Leon, Grace, in the sort of your respective areas?
So together, like I mentioned, we are committed to working together for the next 4 years. So for the duration of the entirety of the program, which is very exciting, but we see this partnership as more long-term, because I feel like the elements that we're incorporating in the survey are elements that we can incorporate in multiple research projects, really. So it's really around understanding what captures the diverse stakeholders' attention and what actually is meaningful to them, and really playing around with those ideas and improving them. So yeah, watch this space, definitely.
Absolutely. And Leon, what are the, I guess, the next steps for you, or what does it look like moving forward with this project?
Yeah, I mean, for me, every customer that we have building on Cognos is just a kind of opportunity to learn and take new things to the next customer who comes on board. And as we mentioned, the Brain and Mind Center, we already work with on a number of things, and we think there's a big future for trying to drive people to collaborate more in this research space and have more visibility around what people are doing. So I'm going to get into the technical weeds about what we do, but you know, we're moving to the point where we're talking to research institutes about the idea of, we have what's called a super app model, where researchers can be building things and sharing them into a single app, and then other researchers can be seeing what they're doing and drive a bit more knowledge and connection. Because in the few years that I've been in the research sector, and I don't think it'll be a surprise for either of you, it's you know, we're always surprised that the person on the left side of the corridor doesn't always know what the person on the right side of the corridor is doing.
So siloed, it's not funny.
and trying to get that, you know, even just within one organization inside a university, let alone other areas of human research, because we see all of this as from a kind of holistic sense. You know, our mission is about how we help people create digital solutions that improve quality of life. Simple as that. Happens to be we're doing lots of stuff in psychology at the moment, but we see all areas of life sciences as interesting for this sort of technology and the role of behavior in these sorts of outcomes. So to that extent, you know, I don't get to work on Grace's project. Other wonderful people here do, and they'll have more of an idea of what they're personally getting out of it. But from my perspective and speaking on behalf of Cognos, it's about what we can learn through that journey of partnering with Grace and see what comes out of that, and how that can inform better ways to build new solutions in the future.
Yeah, that's huge. And I mean, it absolutely is siloed. The right hand doesn't know what the left hand's doing, let alone what the right or left feet are doing. So I think one of the big things that is often sort of lamented at a policy or a decision-making level is the lack of data shareability, and particularly that real-time data shareability. And I mean, it frustrates me, and I'm sure it frustrates both of you, when you sort of are reading demographic studies and it's done from like 5 years ago and there's nothing up to date, and you're like, well, I mean, in 5 years a kid could have been born, or a kid has gone from a teenager to an adult, or a child to a teenager, and people have had multiple jobs. I mean, if I look back at the last 5 years, I would never have thought that I'd be where I working now, or having a podcast and things like that. So to even just look at it generally from a data perspective and a demographic perspective, it is so different. And then to sort of winnow that down to a mental health perspective, and the journeys and the experiences and the varying, I guess, put a crass term on it, mental disorder feathers that an individual may have in their hat or experiences they may have in a hat is definitely needed. And through things like this, this will be super exciting to see that.
Absolutely. And I think that it speaks to a whole change that will happen over time in research. That when you think about it at the moment, whatever you're researching, there's that pick a subject and there'll be researchers all around the world working on this through different lenses and different ways. And the only way that I'm aware of that we really bring that together at the moment is through meta research. So another researcher going and looking at the output of all of those things. And from day one, we've always thought about, well, how do we empower people to use data? So one of the little things that we have in Cognos, which we haven't really, you know, had it, we're not at that stage in the world where people are making use of it, but app owners can actually switch on this thing where, you know, Sam, you're in your version of the app, you actually get a key that allows you to access your data or give access to other parties to that data. So that idea that we might be able to have studies that can start to, share data. And when you combine that with new modalities like sort of micro-randomized trials and more complicated ways of doing research, I think it opens up the door. I mean, just in the, you know, it's probably 10 years ago that I was first involved in speaking to a researcher colleague about some research I wanted done. And at that point, it was very much, well, you can test A versus B versus a control group, and that's it. And that's a very... that the world isn't like that, right? That's a very narrow way to look at things. So, again, I think that's something that is really exciting. But again, it comes back to that issue of there's a whole bigger conversation to have around data ethics and how you manage that type of process. But I can see the frustrations that I continually hear from researchers being addressed in the coming years.
Well, this has just been such a great chat and learning not only more about the Right Care First Time Where You Live project and hearing sort of the coming steps and the way in which Cognos is involved in that and is a formal partner within that, but also hearing about the side that Cognos deals with and the psychoanalysis side and the implementation of all of that. And then I guess to marry it all together, the shareability of data and to better a local healthcare system. So thank you both so much. And yeah, it's been truly wonderful.
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you, Sam. Thanks, Grace. It's a lot of fun.